Sorry about that, Derek. Caught in the middle of doing something on my laptop. It's writer's block. It's Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch for Wednesday. Mr. Deitch, how are you doing?
Well, I mean, you want me to be honest? Like, in terms of a sports context, I'm excited about having so much to watch on TV. It's very cool to see the Blue Jays about to head to the playoffs, but on a larger, more sort of humanity context than what I see in the United States. I mean, I've told you this many times, Jeff, and I won't go further than this statement. There's just not a day that goes by that is not incredibly depressing and frustrating in my native country. That's all I would say. So I'm a bit of a dichotomy. I'm excited to do the show, love talking about sports, but at the same time, that is never far from the back of my mind.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting night tonight.
Yeah, I think that's well said.
Would be the best way to put it. We mentioned that you heard in the update, the Jays will take on the New York Yankees tonight in the third of their four-game series. Good God, Richard, the Yankees can't get the hell out of town fast enough. they really can't get out of town any. I mean, they just can't. They can't get out of town fast enough.
Well, we talked about this yesterday, Jeff. Like, literally, like, again, if there was a matchup where you were putting, like, the most likely pitcher to get a win or to pitch well, I'm talking about just at this moment in this time, against, like, one of the least likely pitchers to pitch well and get a win, it would have been last night's matchup between Gerrit Cole and Tanner Roark. And I'm not saying Tanner Roark is the worst starter in the American League. I'm just saying, given performances, given where things were going, you honestly did not even have to watch yesterday's game. You kind of knew it was going to happen, and now I'm looking forward to today because it feels like if you're a Blue Jays fan, you sort of have, you know, you have more of a shot, and then you start thinking about, and I'm sure we'll get into this with Buck later, but I'm curious about your take. If you've clinched a playoff spot, Jeff, how do you play the three final games of the season? Do you empty the bench and let guys get some PT? Do you avoid using any high leverage reliever? Like how do you play that? Because the reality is they're meaningless games if you're locked into the Rays. So I would not send anybody of note, at least pitching wise, in those three games who I would want against the Rays. In what I would argue, I know it's a three game series, Jeff, but let's be honest, it's really a one game series.
Like, yes.
You win that first game, everything changes.
Well, there's a couple of things. Pardon me. There's a couple of things at work here with that. And I'm at the point now where I think the best matchup for this Jays team, their best chance of getting through the first round is Tampa Bay for a couple of reasons. One, they played Tampa Bay reasonably tough earlier in the year. They lost a lot of tough games. They weren't hitting as well as they are now at the time. They were making a lot of defensive mistakes. They're still doing that, but they are a better team now than they were for great wide swaths of the season when they're playing Tampa. The other thing is they didn't have Robbie Ray and Taijuan Walker when they played Tampa. I mean, they were done with the Rays before the trade deadline. So there may be something there. Some sort of edge in that Tampa Bay may not have seen. Well, they've seen Taijuan Walker because he was in the American League, but they haven't seen him this year. But the way it looks right now, look, their magic number is 2. They can very easily clinch tonight. They're not going anywhere farther than they are right now. The final three games, I mean, I use at least one of the games as a means of keeping guys sharp. I've got to trust my pitchers here. I've got to trust the pitcher to tell me, you know what, Skip, I need an inning tonight. Okay, that's great. You need an inning to stay sharp. I need a couple innings tonight. I've got to trust my pitchers when it comes to that. I'm certainly not pushing the envelope. I'm not going to ask somebody to, you know, quote unquote, ask somebody to give me another inning. And in terms of position players, I mean, I got to keep Teoscar healthy. I would love, I think in a perfect world, in an absolutely perfect world, the games against Baltimore are so meaningless that you can maybe see where Rowdy Tellez is in an actual live game. You can maybe see where Jordan Romano is in an actual live game as opposed to a bullpen session or throwing on the side or whatever. So you can maybe use it that way. But there, it's a fine line because you don't want to overwork guys, obviously, but you don't want to underwork guys. You don't want to find yourself in a position where your high-leverage reliever hasn't pitched for 4 years, or 4 years, for 4 days. Now you bring him in Tuesday in whatever the eighth inning, and he can't find the strike zone. But that's kind of where I am. I feel reasonably comfortable now in saying that we know who the starting three pitchers will be in the postseason. That it should be Ryu, Walker, and Shoemaker. And then perhaps, if he pitches well tonight, Robbie Ray piggybacking off of Matt Shoemaker. But other than that, I'm with you. It's just a matter of keeping everybody. It's a matter of keeping everybody sharp. It's a matter of just, you know, getting guys tuned up for the postseason.
Yeah.
Which could lead to some awful games against Baltimore.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those will be unwatchable. But I'm with you. I think you like, you know, all the regulars you want in game one at some time in the weekend. I think you got to give them some at-bats just to stay sharp. I don't know if I'd play them Sunday unless they really
No, I wouldn't.
To.
I'm with – no, Sunday's a definite off day. Yes.
Yeah, unless it's like Biggio, like some young guys, like I just – or Bo, like I just want more at-bats. But, yeah, I mean, I would really, like, lean towards not playing anybody. And then you just go for it. You know, the one thing, and it's so weird, Jeff, like just because of this crazy weird year, like you're the eighth seed in the American League. So like in theory, if you were the last seed in baseball, like you'd be playing up until the final game and you'd have to like tax your pitchers to make the playoffs. They're in this weird space where they could set everything up for a three game or a singular game series. So in that sense, they're really in a good position. They don't have to use every one of their relievers should be fresh. They're going to be able to set up their rotation how they want it. So, you know, they're not a traditional wild card or sort of late team. They almost get the weird benefit of being like a team that's clinched like 20, you know, like clinched the pennant like 20 days ago. So it's going to be really interesting. But like Charlie and company are going to be able to set everything up how they want. And then, you know, I don't have the data in front of me, but, you know, you've seen all these Rays pitchers before, even the ones that have had success against you. You should be able to optimize your lineup best. And I'm with you. I mean, the Rays are a better team. I don't think there's a question about that. But we watched every one of these games, Jeff. And you can make an argument almost in every game against the Rays that wasn't a blowout. The Blue Jays could have won those games that they lost by a run.
We will be joined by Buck Martinez, as Richard Deitch said, in the 4 o'clock hour. Emily Kaplan joins us in a few minutes as well. Her and Greg Wyshynski did a deep dive into life in the bubble.
It was a great piece.
It was a great piece, and it was extreme. I was the consumption of cannabis edibles by NHL players yeah. was bonus. There was bonus coverage given to that.
You know, Jeff, we'll get into this with
you couldn't do, by the way. There's only a few jurisdictions you could do that in, right?
Can't do that in St. Louis or New York, no. I'll tell you that. The thing that was fascinating to me, and I don't think this is, like, petty or anything. Like, I think this is legit. It was just interesting to read in Greg and Emily's piece how NHL players were sort of envious of the NBA in terms of things like certain food choices. Ooh, and certainly families being able to come. It was, when I read that, it was interesting. It was as if they were a little ticked off at the NHL for not doing some of the detailed-oriented things that the NBA did. And a lot of those players, they're all anonymous, but a lot of those players said that they'd be leaning not necessarily to do this again unless some of those things were changed. So I found that very interesting, and I actually found it very fair. Like, you know, if the Canadians or something like that, or teams that have like some kind of a connection with a caterer or a food company, if they're getting an advantage over other teams, that's a real advantage if you're in this bubble environment.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the first thing I thought of, one of the caveats is you're dealing with more people in an NHL team than you are. And you're
Great
dealing
point.
Essentially twice as yeah. many people in an NHL team as you are in an NBA team. But you're right. It goes without saying that the thing that caught my mind or the thing that caught my attention was was the fact that there was a difference in terms of the quality of food that teams were getting.
Yeah.
You know, that some NHL teams were jealous of the food that another NHL team was getting. And it reminded me of, you know, one of the gripes of Montreal Expos players was that they would always get crappy clubhouse food on the road because they had a lot of young guys, and a lot of young guys weren't making as much money as teams with older guys, so the tips tended to be smaller. And this was really a thing. This was really a thing. You know, the New York Yankees would get food that the Montreal Expos wouldn't get because the visiting clubhouse guy, who would operate basically the more money you give me, the better your grub. I remember talking to LaTroy Hawkins. It was LaTroy Hawkins who was actually, and I'm trying to remember what team he was on, but I remember reading the story. He was one of the first players to step up and say, look, this is stupid. You know, there has to be some sort of standardization here. But I just saw it was kind of funny when I heard this discussion about, you know, some teams getting better food than other teams. Like, there's going to be, it is, I swear to God, it's going to be a great book. I just don't know how the hell anybody's going to write it, because by and large, nobody had access to a lot of stuff going on. But Richard, you know that there was some really funky stuff going on in the bubble. Like, there was.
For sure. And the Jeff, the thing, there was a part in that piece that was just, and again, I'm not, maybe the NHL told the players this and maybe they should have expected it, but guys like checking out of the hotel on the bubble and having like thousands of dollars of like room service on there. Like, I maybe I'm naive, but I would have thought that like the NHL would have comped all that. Like,
so would I.
It just make that to me is just, that's so, that's either nickel and diming or something else. Like, it just, like, if you're going to ask these guys to go into this bubble, if you're going to ask them to essentially change everything about their lives and everything else, like, how have you not come up with some kind of plan with the hotel, Jeff, or like the facility where it's sort of all inclusive, and you know, can you just imagine, like, I don't know,
somebody find like a Marriott lounge or something?
Can you imagine like Morgan Riley checking out last day, and he's got $1,300 of room service? I mean, Morgan obviously can pay for it, but like, that just blew me away. And if I was an NHL player, I would be pissed.
Yeah,
I'm like, are you serious about this?
It's like the old line when you check out, and you know, you check out of your hotel room, and they put the Spectrovision charge on your hotel
charge, and you
can't get it through the company account, and so you try to convince the woman at the front that you accidentally left it on. It doesn't work that way anymore.
That's like 1970s, 80s sports.
I know, there are people going, what the hell are you talking about with Spectrovision? Ask your father. I'm sure he will have some stories. Spectrovision, at one time it was an invention that, by the way.
The web changed all that.
Yes, yeah, somebody's just taking live BP here in Buffalo. At the Blue Jays game, I will endeavor to find out who is pitching during this session. We will also be joined at 3:40 by Tony McIntyre, Orangeville Prep head basketball coach and the Athlete Institute director of basketball operations, Nike Bounce Basketball president and CEO. He might be watching the playoffs, the NBA playoffs, with a little bit of different of interest. Jamal Murray development.
His
development under Tony's watch with the Athlete Institute, Orangeville Prep, and Nike Bounce, and of course what we're seeing now from Jamal Murray.
Jeff, you see Jamal Murray and what he did in that game, and my immediate thought wasn't the Nuggets per se. It was, can you imagine like the Canadian national team, like if they can somehow get to an Olympics, like what you would think about that team today in September of 2020? Versus like 1 year ago. I mean, Jamal Murray, I don't think this is an overstatement, Jeff. Like, when he's on, is like one of the 10 best players now in the NBA.
So I think so, yep.
You're like that team has gotten scary very, very quickly given the development of some of those guys. And against the Lakers, that series was over, I thought. I thought the Lakers, when they cut it to whatever it was, 3 or 2 whatever, in like an 18-2 run. Like, I thought, that's it. Eventually, they're going to pass the Nuggets. The Nuggets are going to submit. It's going to be 3-0, and this series is over. And Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic basically decided that's not going to be the case. That Nuggets team, unbelievable. So much heart and grit.
You know, there's this idea that he's arrived. I mean, I would argue Jamal Murray arrived a long time ago. A lot of people just didn't notice it because, let's face it, the Denver Nuggets are not front of mind. But, I mean, he's got back-to-back seasons of 18-plus points. His first playoff run, I'm just looking at his numbers here, his first playoff run, he averaged 21.3 points, 4.7 assists, 4.4 boards per game. Played well in San Antonio on the road, played well in Portland. I mean, you think about it, the Nuggets came close to making a conference final in his first playoff run. CJ McCollum just absolutely hit a jumper that just stuck a dagger in them. But yeah, he is something else. You know, and this guy is on a 5-year, $169.65 million contract that doesn't kick in until next year. But yeah, he has arrived. It's just, as I said, I kind of almost feel guilty because it's not that we don't spend time talking about Jamal Murray, but when we talk about the rise of Canadian basketball, it always seems to be sort of focused on the Raptors and their run to the championship. And you know, the Canadian men's team, if they could ever get it together, it's really good. But it's almost as if we don't think of Jamal Murray. You know, we don't see a lot of his commercials up here, right?
Well, he's in a weird city, Jeff, just for like publicity. You know, it's Chicago, New York, LA. Regardless of where you are in North America, you kind of get like still like a little of the taste of the big cities. But he's in Denver, which is its own, you know, unique time zone. And if you're not in that part of the world, you know, I mean, how many times like do we see Nuggets games just in general on Canadian television? I guess unless, you know, someone's picking up the TNT or ESPN game, they're not a franchise that resonates that much even outside of Denver. So it doesn't surprise me that we're not so familiar with his development, but like that's what these playoffs have become. There's going to be a couple of guys who at the end of this run, like sort of were the stories of the NBA bubble, and Jamal Murray will be on that top five. He's one of the top five stories in the NBA bubble already.
It's interesting. Carlin Gay of NBA.com has written a terrific article on Jamal Murray, and I love this line. Jamal Murray is everything Canada wanted Andrew Wiggins to be and everything the country hopes R.J. Barrett will become. I mean, that is it in a nutshell. That is it in a nutshell. It's a perfect description. Perfect description of him. So we look forward to Tony McIntyre joining us to discuss Jamal Murray and get a sense of what Jamal Murray was like as a kid, essentially. And I'm not going to. Did you see this coming? I don't know if any coach would say he saw this coming of a teenager. But
I will say, Jeff, that again, this is sort of just a college basketball point. But you look around, particularly in the bubble, guys who have just like blown up. So many of them from Kentucky. Tyler Hero,
yes,
Bam
sir.
Adebayo. I mean, not surprising. Kentucky's always gotten great. But, like, it's, like, literally, like, this particular bubble has been, like, a showcase of Kentucky basketball. And, you know, I don't know how many people remember Jamal Murray was at Kentucky for a little bit. But yeah. And, again, I'm looking at the depth chart of Canada basketball right now. And you mentioned RJ and Jamal Murray. And Kelly Olynyk and Dylan Brooks. I mean, you know, Dwight Powell and Pangos. Andrew Wiggins? We never even get to. Is it the U.S.? No, but if those guys could play a little bit together, that's a real legitimate medal contention team. Now that Jamal Murray's become one of the 10 best players in the world.
Absolutely. So, what was life like, or what is life like? Because it's still going on in the NHL bubble. Well, Emily Kaplan and Greg Wyshynski gave us a taste of it. And, you know, two words, cannabis edibles. Emily Kaplan joins us next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. watching the live feed of the of Salem Field in Buffalo, where the Toronto Blue Jays are suspiciously like they're getting ready for some sort of live batting practice. And Rowdy Tellez is holding a batting helmet and bat and has his gloves on. So it looks as if we may see Rowdy Tellez taking some swings in a sim game today, which would certainly add a little optimism to the possibility of Rowdy Tellez being available for the postseason in some form. And I'll keep an eye on it, providing the camera stays on him. We'll keep an eye on it throughout and give you updates as we go on. We mentioned before the break that Greg Wyshynski and Emily Kaplan got together and for ESPN and wrote an article on life in the NHL bubble. And we're very pleased to be joined by Emily Kaplan. And Emily, I've got to tell you that, I mean, the thing Richard Deitch and myself were talking about, I mean, there was a lot about the article that really, you know, that really surprised me. I expected there'd be sort of a, you know, a greater standardization of food, a greater standardization of services. You know, those are the words I'm thinking of. I just expected everybody would be treated the same, and my guess is the players did as well. But that does not seem to have been the case.
Yeah, well, firstly, thank you guys for having me on. You know, it's funny because the NHL, and if we know anything about Gary Bettman, he's obsessed with parity. Like, we call it the Parity League. Everything is created to have an equal playing field for all the 31, soon to be 32 teams. But, you know, in this global pandemic, things aren't exactly an even playing field. And when the guys negotiated to come back, you know, they were promised certain things. And, you know, a lot of it was really rushed, as patient as the NHL was. They had to put this whole tournament together. But, you know, some guys, as they were talking to me, almost were piecing it together as we were having these conversations of, you know what, some teams with deeper pockets had much better amenities than we had. Like the Montreal Canadiens had a table that was always available with smoothies and wraps, whereas other teams had to fend for themselves for every meal, even though they had per diem. Just think how much easier it is if you're an elite athlete if that healthy, nourishing food is just available for you.
Emily, I enjoyed your piece. It was really, really interesting. And from talking to all the players that you talked to, my sense was that the toughest thing for them, obviously, was the lack of inclusion of family or friends or girlfriends, spouses, partners. If you think the NHL ever had to do that again, would that, how big a deal breaking point would that be, in your opinion, for the players?
I think it's a non-starter for the next time they do a bubble, if they have to do a bubble. I really do. And you look, I think all of the guys are cognizant of the fact that the Canadian government has very strict quarantine rules. For people not from Canada right now, it's 14 days. And yes, the NHL worked out a deal with them for the players and staffers. But the issue with the players was they just felt like this was something that was promised to them. And then throughout the process, the NHLPA and NHL were both moving the goalposts. There was a lack of transparency. And ultimately, a lot of players just felt like the NHLPA and NHL didn't fight for them to have their family members come, even though it was something promised. So next time, if there is a next time, that is something that absolutely players are going to want to have in writing.
Emily, what's your read on what next time will look like? I mean, I'll get back to the article in question in a minute. But, you know, look, we've had Adam Silver talk about sort of his, what he thinks the NBA timetable is going to be. We know Major League Baseball is planning on starting spring training at a regular time. No indication yet that there will be fans in the stands. And I think a lot of people have just kind of twinned the NHL and the NBA together because they're kind of, the calendars appear to be sort of moving in lockstep right now. But bubble or no bubble, you know, bubble setup, multiple bubbles, however you want to describe it. What's your best sense on when the NHL gets going next season? And further to that point, do you think the NHL will wait until the very last minute that would allow them to get fans into the arena? Or do you think they may just go ahead and say, look, we'll start, we've got to pick a start date. We'll start, we'll give our players, our coaches, our teams an idea of when we're going to start. And then if fans come back in, that's great.
So the one thing I'm confident about is that the NHL is going to take the same approach it took for this summer's restart, which is be as patient as possible in, you know, declaring any firm dates or locations, just because we don't know what the world's going to look like weeks or months from now. So I don't think we're going to hear anything until, I would say, November at the very earliest. I feel also pretty confident that we're going to see something progressive. I don't think that we're in a position anytime soon to uniformly welcome fans back into arena at full capacity. That said, the NHL is a league more so than the other leagues that is gate driven. They don't get most of their money from TV contracts. They do get a lot of money from the gate. So it is really important to get fans in. So I can see a situation where you begin and, you know, maybe some of the markets in states where there's more lax laws. I'm talking about like in Arizona, Texas, or Florida. You know, maybe they come in at 25 or 50% capacity at first. And then, you know, probably Canadians. I can't imagine the Canadian government allowing fans in the stands and arenas in some U.S. states at first. But, you know, slowly, gradually adding up until we return to some normalcy. As for when this is all happening, you know, we heard that December start date. You know, they had to just put in the memorandum of understanding. At this point, January is the best case scenario, in my opinion. If we start in January, that would be a win. I've heard some people, you know, at league and team office level, just, you know, talking about March as something that could possibly happen. And, you know, the format of the season is going to be fascinating. If we have to do some kind of hybrid bubble situation or try to figure out how to, you know, get the schedule expedited, maybe we just see another one big expanded Stanley Cup tournament again. Like, that's not out of the realm of possibility either.
Emily, one last thing from your piece that, that just blew me away. Maybe it was my own naivete, but, and I was talking to Blair about this in the opening of the show. I just cannot imagine if you're an NFL player, if you're an NHL player, you check out of your hotel room, you know, you got your luggage, you're ready to finally get out of the bubble and go home. You hand the hotel clerk your key, and you get back a massive room service bill that has not been provided or paid for by the league. That was really, really interesting to me in your piece. And I would have to think, like, I don't actually think this is petty given what these players were asked to do. I would have to think that pissed the hell off of those who saw those charges at the end of the stay.
For sure. And I think, look, they're getting per diem, so you could say that their per diem go towards that bill. But these are luxury hotels in Canada where things are expensive. That stuff adds up pretty quickly on room service. And, you know, I think this is the main gripe that a lot of players had is like, why was food just not, all meals should have been provided and available, because you were making some guys, especially guys on entry-level contracts. I know we think of these guys as millionaires, but thousands of dollars, like that adds up. Like that's how you see your salary diminish pretty quickly. So yeah, they were pretty upset by that. And that was definitely something. Again, if we have to do this again, might be put into writing that it doesn't happen.
But one of the other aspects of your article that certainly got my attention, and it's something that I had somebody mention to me early in this process, and I didn't think of it necessarily, but they said, well, if they bubble in Canada, they can use cannabis edibles. And, you know, guys are going to be, you know, there's going to be playing, guys are going to be hurt. I kind of chuckled at it. But it appears as if there were some cannabis edibles consumed, shall we say. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, far from it, but I wonder if when this is all done, Emily, we may be surprised how many players sought additional means of helping them heal. And I mean that, I'm not saying that facetiously. I mean that completely, as a completely legitimate possibility.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a story about weed in the NHL over the last couple of years, and I do think it's a little more prevalent than we think, especially, you know, with Canada being the largest country in the world to legalize marijuana and most states now playing in teams playing in jurisdictions where you can get it. But yeah, you know, as some of the guys were telling me, it was an isolating experience. It's a stressful experience, but at the same time, guys are trying to perform the best they can. And so while, you know, there was some alcohol being passed around and being drank, you know, weed gummies were just as prevalent, and a lot of guys find that as a more natural alternative for recovery and rest. And as one player explained it to me, it's not like they were smoking or eating gummies just to get stoned and disengaged from society. They're really using it of like, hey, I had a game. I want to fall asleep at a reasonable hour afterwards so I can get some sleep in. Like, this is the best way to do it.
Emily, you traveled from the States to Canada and quarantined to cover the last part of the postseason. What has that been like for you in terms of just the isolation part, the you know, finally sort of, I guess, getting freed from quarantine and then being you have to be one of only a handful, I would think, of reporters who are live at the arena covering games, at least digital print reporters.
Yeah. Well, I like to think I've been preparing this for this the last 6 months, Richard. So I think I made a series of good decisions in quarantine. Like, I got an Airbnb, had a kitchen and a backyard, knowing that fresh air is super important in these times. It's definitely surreal just to be here in general. And not only am I one of a handful of print reporters here, I'm only one of three Americans covering this. There's Stephen Wino from the Associated Press and Dennis Bernstein from the Fourth Period. And besides us three, there's no other Americans here at the Stanley Cup Final. So I'm just really grateful for the opportunity that ESPN, you know, supported me through this so that we could be here, you know, for this incredibly unique Stanley Cup Final. And I think one day I'll step back and look at this experience, but right now in it, I just can't quite see past the tunnel.
Now, Emily, you know, the I guess one of the dominant storylines here, or the dominant storyline here in terms of this series, is when we are going to see Steven Stamkos. I'm not certain it's if anymore. What do you think Tampa Bay's approach with Steven Stamkos would be? We had Brian Burke on, and he made the point that perhaps, you know, you bring Steven Stamkos in, you use him on the power play. You know, clearly you're not just going to dress him and have him sit in the bench and not take part. I mean, he's going to have to do something. But how would you see them working him back into the equation here?
Yeah, the power play is the obvious. You know, I think he could take regular power play shifts. But if you think of the power play, it's not that much hard skating, not so much battle. Right. Those are the type of things that are going to be difficult for him. You know, it's tough because any top player in the league is used to playing long shifts, and I'm not sure that, you know, his conditioning would allow for that. But also, I was talking to Chris Versteeg. I know he does a lot of work with Sportsnet, and he was just saying his timing is off because these guys have now been playing in the groove of 2.5 months, really,
right.
And he's not been a part of that. So I'm with you. I think it's a when, not if. You know, we didn't see morning skate today because we can only see the home team. So maybe he makes the lineup.
Game 4 or 5, though, that seems reasonable.
Sorry, Richard?
Go ahead, Jeff.
No, go ahead. That's fine. Sorry, I blanked out for a minute here. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about this the current series. And one, what you thought of the quality of play. And two, and this is kind of something I was thinking about. Like, my sense is that, one, I think the accomplishment is amazing, and whoever wins, there's no asterisk on it. At the same time, I don't think there will be any carryover at all. Or any kind of like momentum play, like I think whoever wins between the Stars and Lightning, while both excellent teams, I'm not sure it will mean anything next year when you are sort of scouting and looking at who you might think will win that cup, because just the whole world is going to be different. So let's take the first part. What have you thought of the quality of the final so far?
I think the quality has been great, and look, I think we have to give so much credit to these guys because it is an adjustment playing in an empty arena. Like, I don't care if they've been doing it for 2 months, it's still weird, and they have to create their own energy. And, you know, Dallas Stars obviously came out, they're a big physical team. Tampa made the adjustments in game 2. They're all treating this incredibly professionally. And being in the arena, too, this is just a side note, it's different. Like, on TV, it sounds so seamless with the ambient crowd noise because there is that 5-second delay. In the arena, we have the ambient crowd noise, too, but it's not as seamless because it's happening, you know, simultaneously. So sometimes it sounds a little off. As your second question is if there's going to be carryover, I'm kind of with you. And, you know, if you even look at last year to this year, because things have been so disrupted, like the St. Louis Blues had zero momentum as being, you know, the cup champs from last year. They were one of the teams that everyone was kind of gossiping about, didn't want to be there, wasn't fully engaged. It's just really hard right now, and to get everybody on the same page, to get everyone clicking at the right time. So, you know, these are two teams that are so deserving of being here. They've really battled through a lot, have improved every round, especially the Stars. But you're right, this is a unique year. We're going to remember this year forever, and I think we'll remember this champion forever.
Emily, good stuff. Really appreciate you joining us. Thank you. Stay safe, and enjoy the remaining bubble time that you have, if you can.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care. That's Emily Kaplan. She's a national NHL reporter with ESPN. Tony McIntyre, Orangeville Prep head basketball coach, head of the Athlete Institute, and Nike Bounce basketball president and CEO. He is a man who saw Jamal Murray when Jamal Murray was very young and starting out. He's now one of the stories of the NBA bubble. Tony McIntyre will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Martinez will join us at 4 o'clock. Ren Lavoie as well. Well, we spent a great portion of the first part of the show talking about Jamal Murray and the way he has written himself large all over these NBA playoffs. And I mentioned, you know, I think people are saying Jamal Murray has arrived. Well, I mean, clearly the Denver Nuggets think he arrived ahead of us because they gave him a great gob amount of money in order to as a contract. But the fact of the matter is, look, the way players perform in the postseason, especially I think in the NBA, is the measure of a great player. And Jamal Murray in Denver's win over in their win over the LA Lakers was phenomenal. 28 points, he had 8 boards, he had 12 assists, shot just under 60% from the field. He has been, as I said, one of the emerging stories out of the NBA bubble, and is a guy that, as Richard Deitch pointed out, when we think about what the Canadian men's Olympic team could look like at some point down the road and we close our eyes and you imagine the level of talent that will be available, it is certainly remarkable. Tony McIntyre is Orangeville Prep head basketball coach. He is also president and CEO of Nike Bounce Basketball and the director of basketball operations at the Athlete Institute. This is a man who saw Jamal Murray develop, saw him as a younger player. We're very pleased to be joined by Tony McIntyre. Tony, thank you so much for joining us. Look, I mentioned Jamal. It's not as if he's just burst on the scene. He's you know, clearly been one of the best young players in the NBA. It's still, I think, largely because of where he plays. You know, people, it's not always in the front of mind. That certainly has changed, though, in this postseason, hasn't it? Like, he has really become, to me, he might be one of the 10 best players in the game. I mean, I'll just say it.
No, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, thank goodness this bubble happened. I think a lot of people are paying attention to, you know, what's happening in that bubble. And he, you know, I'm going to say he's breaking out, but he's been doing it. And, you know, probably should have been an all-star the last two seasons. And I think now is kind of catapulted past just being an all-star into superstar status.
Tony, can you, you know, one of the things that I, you know, human scouting as a general rule, sort of one of the hardest things to do both in athletics and in life, you know. That's why there's probably a 50% divorce rate, let's be honest. So I wonder from your perspective, like in someone like Jamal's basketball journey, like when do you, like you've obviously had a lot of good players, but when do you know like someone like him is not just a good player, but like a potentially first round pick, potentially transcended kind of guy? Like I'd love you to give our audience just a sense of, you know, his development and maybe when you knew he's just a different player than other great players around him.
I think it goes, you know, as a guy that's been around the game for a long time, I think you obviously see it. You see talent in kids. You see Jamal was a little bit different. And the kids that tend to go on to, you know, be great college basketball players and then into the NBA are just a little bit different. Their work ethic, the mental preparation, their dedication to the game, their commitment to not look for outside influences and really lock in was evident with Jamal. You know, he'd spend late nights in our gym with his father Roger coming up here, his workouts, his meditation sessions. He'd be shooting free throws in the dark. He was just built different. He was really, you know, everyone says it and it sounds cliche, but he was built for these moments. He wants the big shot. He wants to be in a situation where he's the underdog and down and prove that he could come back, and he strives on that. And he's always, you know, strived on that. And you see him do this since, 9th, 10th, 11th grade in big moments. I think the turning point for him was probably a breakout at Nike Hoop Summit out in Portland, where he was MVP. And, just kind of had a coming out party there. And then you knew it was, you know, just a matter of time. He was going to go to Kentucky for a year and be in the NBA and be able to start to show everybody just how good he is.
Tony, I always love asking guys who coached players this, but when you watch Jamal now, and you're watching a game on TV, what are the things that tell you that he's going to have one of those really good games or that it might be a little off tonight?
I think with Jamal, I mean, you look at last night and you look at, you know, in these series when he was down 3-1, there's just a look in his eye, and there's a certain point, like when I see Jamal, you know, hit a fadeaway three and give the bench a look, I know, like, if he gets his hands on this ball, you know, I've seen this look so many times. I just know that the next one's going in and the next one's going in, and he wants the next one. And last night was kind of one of those nights, you know, when he got tangled up with LeBron and you saw him kind of jawing back and forth with LeBron and they called the flagrant on him, I knew, like, oh, this is, at some point tonight, he's going to go off, just because he's built for this and he wants that challenge and that matchup, and he's on that stage now.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting, and I wanted to, Tony, get your perspective on this, and I imagine you believe it too. There's a lot of guys will sort of use being slighted or sort of the whole mantra, nobody believes in me, nobody believes in us. And I think sometimes that works, and sometimes, let's be honest, it's just pure cliche. But I do think that there is something to being from Canada and not being part of, like, the U.S. AAU circuit or being tabbed when you're, like, 13, 12, 14, 15 years old as the next LeBron. And I know Jamal has talked about this, but, like, I buy it. I buy great high school players from Canada going into college and then going into the pros feeling with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder that Canadian basketball is as good as U.S. basketball. And I wonder, from your perspective, have you seen Jamal sort of use that, talk about that to fuel him to where he is now?
I think in general, Canadian basketball players, when they go off to college or in the NBA, you know, have that chip on their shoulder, and, you know, you're always compared to, but, you know, Jamal was one of the first to kind of stop the trend of players going to the States for high school and came up here to Orangeville. And that was always something that we fought against, of trying to get into the better tournaments, trying to get Jamal and Thon against the best players down in the U.S. And it was always something where it's like, hey, even from a ranking standpoint, you know, the American scouting services aren't going to rank Canadian players that play in Canada. They'll only rank a Canadian player if he plays at a U.S. school. So for that, it's kind of you end up with that chip on your shoulder. But I think as a Canadian, it's always, you know, the expectations are a little bit different, and there's not as high expectations for a Canadian player, even though I think, you know, talented-wise and numbers-wise, we're producing them at a very high rate right now of very, very good players coming from Canada performing in the NBA.
Tony, really good of you to join us. Congratulations on your role in developing Jamal, and it sure is fun watching him, and we appreciate you joining us.
No, thanks for having me on, and I love doing this and promoting these young ballers, and, you know, hopefully we can keep this up.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thank you.
Tony McIntyre, Orangeville Prep head basketball coach. He is Nike Bounce basketball president and CEO, and also the director of basketball ops with the Athlete Institute, and his point about Jamal Murray is well made. It's something that I know Paul Jones has talked about when we've talked about Jamal Murray. You know, the fact that this kid did what he did and he did not go to one of the big U.S. prep schools. And, whatever works for you. I'm not going to criticize anybody for doing anything. by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a part of the Jamal Murray story that... Go ahead, Richard.
Sure about the Jamal. The only thing I was going to add really quick was just that, you know, the Raptors obviously will be the catalyst for younger kids playing basketball, whatever kids are 5 or 10, 11 now, whatever they become 5, 10 years from now. The Raptors will be the number one catalyst. But, and I think you'd agree with me, Jeff, the second catalyst or the secondary catalyst are going to be players like Jamal Murray and R.J. Barrett and kids who are like 11, 12 years old right now watching the playoffs and seeing a kid from Kitchener doing what he's doing. You know, that's the kind of role modeling stuff that can lead to a country becoming a bigger and better basketball country. So I don't think you can understate the importance of what he is doing regarding an impact in this country on basketball, given that we are seeing him in the biggest situations on primetime television, you know, essentially matching LeBron James, one of the greatest, if not the greatest basketball player of all time.
And as our producer Travis McKenzie points out, Thon Maker was the other player that Tony McIntyre was referring to. I want to shout out, by the way, Matt in Guelph says, hey, I went to high school with both Jamal Murray and Mark Scheifele. Talk about some great alums. Grand River Collegiate Institute, baby. So there you go, Matt from Guelph. Shout out to his alma mater, to his high school.
For two pretty good players and two pretty good sports. Yeah.
that's actually very true. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays TV analyst on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. It's Masahiro Tanaka on the mound for the Blue Jays, Yankees tonight. Robbie Ray on the mound for the Blue Jays. The Jays coming off a 12-1 thumping at the hands of the Yankees. Two more games against the Jays or against the Yankees, and then three against Baltimore, and it's postseason time, folks. What is Robbie Ray pitching for tonight? We'll find out. Buck Martinez will join us. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Play the third of four games against the New York Yankees tonight from Salem Field in Buffalo. The Blue Jays, as we're speaking, taking batting practice right now, coming off a 12-1 loss to the Yankees last night. They will face Masahiro Tanaka tonight. Robbie Ray on the mound for the Blue Jays. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays analyst on Sportsnet. He'll join us in a few minutes. The first pitch of that game, by the way, is at 6:37. It is on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and on Sportsnet Blue Jays Central on the TV side will precede the game. Again, that'll be at 6 o'clock. The Jays have two more games against the Yankees, three more against the Baltimore Orioles, and their magic number to clinch a playoff spot is 2. So any combination of Jays wins / Seattle Mariners losses, and the Blue Jays will have clinched a spot and most likely a meeting with the Tampa Bay Rays in the best of three first round. It'll be fascinating because the Jays and the Rays seem to be playing each other every day when baseball came back from the pandemic pause. And they have not faced each other since the Jays made some acquisitions. The trade deadline, bringing in Robbie Ray, Taiwan Walker, and Jonathan Villar. So this will be a different-looking pitching staff than the one that the Jays ran out against the Rays. We're having a little difficulty tracking down Buck right now. So, Richard, as we talked about a little earlier in the show, it appears as if it'll be Tampa. These teams have played tight games. The Jays, I think you're right, have been in a position to win most of the close games. They had some particularly gruesome losses and some particularly gruesome misplays against the Rays. But I wonder if maybe the fact that Tampa hasn't seen this team since it one added some of those pitchers at the deadline. But also, I mean, I don't think they've seen this team with sort of as constructed as it is right now.
Yeah, I agree. The Jays are a better team than the team that Tampa saw earlier, and just even more at bats for younger guys. Like, to me, you know, Kevin Biggio is a better player now, you know, in the middle of September than he was at the beginning of the year. Walker is, you know, they've added a power arm that they didn't have. At the same time, I mean, the Rays are good, Jeff. I mean, I think either you picked them to win World Series or go to the World Series. I mean, they're a legit, excellent team. The one thing we saw against the Blue Jays early this year is they never give up at-bats. They never basically give up on a game. So that's why you see them win, in my opinion, a lot of one-run games. They're incredibly smart. They're just well-managed, well-scouted. They have a lot of players that, while they're not as famous as like Giancarlo Stanton or Aaron Judge, they're really good major league players. That said, if you're a Jays fan and you're looking for a little bit of optimism, you know, their September record, Jeff, isn't like lights out. They had a stretch where they lost three games to the Nationals and one to Boston. They rolled over Baltimore in their four-game series that they had, I think, last week. But, you know, one up, one down against the Mets. So, again, they're a very, very good team. But by no means, in my opinion, are they some kind of juggernaut or like a team that is an absolute lock to win a World Series. So I think game one, this is no genius take, is the series. I think if you're the Blue Jays, you have to win game one. I don't think there's any chance of you winning game two and game three. And you're probably going to go against Blake Snell, I guess, right, who's excellent. And, you know, and you just hope that's the one day where these young offensive guys are on. But the thing about the Blue Jays, Jeff, is, like, that can happen. Like, there are games we have seen this year where, like, you know, if everybody's hot, Teoscar's hot, Grichik's hot, Bo's hot, Biggio's hot, Vladdy gets hot. I mean, they got some bats in the lineup. So I'm really looking forward to it. And I think, again, I said this with Tim Leeper. I will continue to stick with this. This, to me, will be a year where you will see one very surprising team in the World Series. And I also think in the first couple rounds, you're going to see some upsets based on seeding. I just think it's that kind of year.
Yeah, that team will be the Padres or the Reds. Let's bring in Buck Martinez, our Blue Jays TV analyst, sportsman. Hey, Buck, thanks for doing this. So Robbie Ray is pitching tonight. Now, I think we know Hyunjin Ryu is going to start game one. I think we're reasonably comfortable Taiwan Walker starts in game two. What's Robbie Ray pitching for tonight?
I think he's pitching for an opportunity to have a big role in the postseason. I think he and Matt Shoemaker are probably on even keel right now, even playing. I think if I were a betting man, I would say that Shoemaker starts game three, if there is a game three, and Robbie Ray backs him up.
Buck, this is something that Jeff and I were talking about earlier in the show. You already know who your opponent's going to be, unless something insane happens in the next couple days, and that it's the Rays. And you have the ability to really set things up, which I think most teams, like in the seeding position that the Blue Jays would be in, would not normally have. They'd be playing for a spot last weekend of the season. So if you're Charlie and Ross and company, how would you approach the series with the Orioles in terms of who gets some at-bats, and would you use any high leverage reliever, or would you just basically, you know, for lack of a better word, everybody on the bench comes in this weekend and they get their reps?
No, I wouldn't do the latter, that's for sure. You know what, the season's only 60 games long. And, you know, everybody's thinking like you've played 162 games and you got to have an off day before the playoffs starts, and I don't buy any of that. I think you have to maintain a momentum. If you can gather momentum here at the end of the season, you have to maintain it and carry it right in through that first wild card series. As far as Charlie's planning, I don't think Charlie's planning on doing anything until they clinch a spot. And, yeah, you know, the front office and some of the coaches and all those people can think about what if we do play Tampa Bay. And obviously they know Tampa Bay very well. They've played them a lot. They've played them 10 times already this year. And, you know, when they saw Tampa Bay in the first series, Blake Snell wasn't throwing like he is now. He was a little bit better the second time they saw him. But, you know, they're a good team. They're a very good team. But, you know, they don't have Austin Meadows either. So everybody's a little dinged up right now, except the Yankees. They seem to be the healthiest in the American League right now. But I think you have to keep everybody on track. I mean, if Hyunjin Ryu pitches tomorrow and it's a regular game and you haven't clinched anything, I think he has to give you as much as he's got. Because if he does start game one, that's on Tuesday, and that'd be on normal rest. So I'm not concerned about saying, oh, Ryu only goes I think Ryu only goes so many innings because he's going to start on Tuesday. I think you let Ryu pitch to how well he's pitching and just play it by ear. As far as not getting the regulars in, I think you got to play all the regulars and make sure they get enough at-bats to get some momentum going into that series. Yeah, if you don't want to play them on Sunday, that's one thing. But I'd make sure they all get plenty of at-bats, and I'd ask each and every one of them how many at-bats they feel like they need in that Baltimore series.
Buck, what are you hearing about Rowdy Tellez?
Well, I watched him just a minute ago, and they said that Rowdy was going to take live BP yesterday. We just watched him track pitches from Sean Reed Foley. He didn't swing at all.
Right.
Now, you know, he may hit in BP. I don't know. You know, I think it's a stretch for him to even consider being on the playoff roster. You know, I went through the same thing in 85 when I broke my leg. And you come down to the end of the season, you hadn't played in several weeks in Rowdy's case, and you're still not 100%, and how valuable can you be? I would love to have Rowdy Tellez on the roster that was hitting prior to the injury.
Right.
No question about that. But as far as saying, you know, he's fine now, he's ready to go, the intensity of these postseason games is going to be ramped up from the regular season. And he hasn't faced pitching in a long time. I think it'd be a real long shot for him.
Buck, I'm curious how you think the best of three plays here, or how you might sort of think about a best of three series against the Rays as opposed to a best of five. What would that mean to you in terms of just sort of lineups or strategy? How does that really shortened series work versus a traditional best of five or traditional best of seven?
Well, first of all, it's better than a one-game playoff like wild card used to be, so that's one good thing.
Yep.
Secondly, I think, you know, over the course of a three-game series, you know, you have a little bit of a chance to get into the flow of things. I mean, obviously, you don't want to go down one game to the A's and look at Glasnow pitching game two. I mean, to the Rays and look at Glasnow pitching game two. So, with Ryu out there, he was not pitching great when the Rays first saw him. He opened up the season down there in St. Pete, and he wasn't pitching as he is right now. So I think the Blue Jays have just as good a chance as anybody to advance in this wild card series. And, you know, they've played the Rays tough all year long, and I consider they will play them rough again if they meet up in the postseason.
Buck, have you seen enough from Alejandro Kirk? I think I know the answer to this, but have you seen enough from Alejandro Kirk that you would be comfortable DHing him in a postseason game?
I would be more comfortable DHing him than I would be catching him.
Hey, there you go. Thank you. That was my next question, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've seen a little bit of the inexperience the last couple of games behind the plate. He's having trouble with the signs. He's having trouble, you know, with his target. He's setting up a little prematurely. He's doing things that you expect an A-ball catcher to do. But as far as swinging the bat, I have no problem. I wouldn't be surprised if he DHs in game one if they meet up against Blake Snell.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the options they have, I mean, he's swinging the bat as well as anybody right now. So that would not bother me one bit if he was the DH in game one and Danny was catching. But I would be more comfortable with him at DH than I would be behind the plate.
Buck, I love the idea just in sports of X factors, things that can swing a series or things that may have an impact that you just don't know what will happen until it happens. How would you approach using Nate Pearson, one, this weekend, assuming he'll sort of maybe be able to get into one game, and then probably the more important question, during a playoff series against the Rays, where would you slot him in what kind of situation at this point?
I'm not slotting him into anything until I see him pitch. You know, people don't realize, and Nate wasn't real good before he got hurt. And now, you know, everybody say, well, we need Nate Pearson back. Well, he wasn't that good before. So I think that's the one issue you have to resolve. You know, how good was he? I watched him throw the other day, and yeah, it looked like his stuff was okay, but guys were taking pretty good swings off him. But, you know, I'm not making any judgments on Nate Pearson until I see him pitch in a regular game before the end of the season. And I think the Blue Jays are in the same situation. I don't think you can just say, well, he's going to be great, because he had some moments, but consistently he wasn't dominant like we expected him to be when he was healthy.
I think it was you and Danny who first flagged us to the idea that the Jays were having difficulty handling elite velocity. I remember it was something you talked about. I remember a graphic, and I cannot remember the game, but I remember the graphic Scotty Carson had provided that broke that down. And I'm sure I've asked you about this, but now that we're a week away from the playoffs and, you know, we've got a little larger sample size, but can you explain to me just a very simple question, how a team of young hitters can have difficulty with elite velocity? Like, I could see if you're a bunch of 45-year-old guys, but how can a young team have difficulty with elite velocity?
And, Jeff, I think what they're doing is they're trying to cover the breaking balls and get a good stroke and a good approach and a good game plan at the plate. And because of that, they have been a little bit late on fastballs. And, you know, they've been among the best all year long at hitting breaking balls. And when you really think about it, the major league average for fastball usage is 50%. And it's just like that's the way baseball is right now. And, yeah, lately there's been a big deal about it. They don't hit well against fastballs over 95. But at the same time, you know, there's a handful of those guys. And we saw one last night, of course, in Gerrit Cole. But I think this is going to resolve itself. I think what they're trying to do is building a good foundation for the hitters and, you know, handling the breaking ball, getting on that, developing a good approach like Teoscar. I mean, here's a great example. Teoscar's able to lay off the breaking ball, hit the hanging breaking balls, and murder the fastballs. I mean, he's the best fastball hitter they have on their team. And I think that you're going to see a transition into better fastball hitters as they get more experience under their belt. I think it's just a process.
Buck, I'm curious. I know that the sort of the de facto answer a lot of times is, you know, who might be favored to win this, whether it's the Dodgers or the Rays or the Yankees. But from what you've seen both calling Blue Jays games this year and just in your own viewing, who are a couple of the teams that will be in the postseason who may be a little bit – under the radar for those of us in Toronto that you'll be keeping your eye on because maybe they have the potential to get hot in this unprecedented postseason and do something?
The two Ohio teams, Cincinnati and Cleveland. I think they both have a very good pitching staff, Cleveland, and we know what kind of pitching they have. And right now, Jose Ramirez might be the hottest hitter on the planet. And the same goes for Cincinnati. They've got those three starters at the top of their order that are all pretty good. And Sonny Gray came back last night and pitched good. So I think those guys can be sleepers. And I don't think anybody wants to face Cincinnati in the first round. They're starting to swing the bats a little bit better. And they have Castillo, they have Bauer, and they have Sonny Gray. And that's all you need in a five-game series. And somebody else will have to pitch. And Lorenzen's been pitching well for them as well in the fourth spot. So, you know, those two teams I keep my eye on. And, yes, you know, Cleveland doesn't score a lot of runs. But, you know, the Blue Jays played them in the postseason. And they understand you don't have to score a lot of runs when you pitch well and the other team doesn't score. So I think I would look at those two teams as teams that can advance and go a little bit deeper into the postseason.
Buck, it was really good of you to join us. Thanks so much. Look forward to your call tonight.
All right. Good to be with you guys. You have a great night.
You too. This is Buck Martinez. He is our Blue Jays analyst on Sportsnet. He and Danny will have the call tonight as the Jays take on the New York Yankees. So just to give you a little bit of an update, as I mentioned, we have the television monitors in the studio that are on live at Salem Field in Buffalo. Rowdy Tellez took live batting practice yesterday. Today he was in the cage. Again, it was live batting practice. Sean Reed Foley pitching. He had a bat. He was wearing a helmet, had his gloves, but he was just tracking pitches, which essentially means he's just letting the pitches go by and just sort of trying to get used again to the idea of pitches with some velocity coming in. So it's more process of just seeing pitches than it is really trying to do anything with them. But there you are. And I think Buck is probably right. I would, as much as we get excited about Rowdy Tellez and as much as you'd like to see his bat, I think it's far more likely that you would see Rowdy in a second round should the Jays get there than in the first round.
I mean, Jeff, it's not a perfect obviously Rowdy Tellez is not Kirk Gibson, but Rowdy Tellez always gives me the feel of that guy who, like, in the postseason, who has been injured, hasn't played, it's going to limp to home plate. You know, he's got his, like, uniform sort of not perfectly fitting. He's a big dude. And then he hits you, like, that game-winning home run in the ninth inning. But I like that guy. I think he is a – how do I sort of say this? I know it's an analytics game and stuff, but he's just – he's a hitter to me. And I think he's a valuable guy to have in a DH/first base position. And he was having, while a streaky year, I thought a very, very good year. So I would love to see him back. But I think your instinct here is correct. It feels like the far more likelihood of that would be second round than first. I will say this, Jeff, and I saw Ben Nicholson's tweet not too long ago, getting Jordan Romano back healthy would be huge. To get a power arm in leverage situations against the Rays, I feel like, man, that would be valuable, especially given how well he pitched this year.
Yeah, as long as he's pitching the way he was before he was hurt. I mean, it's the same caveat, you know, as Buck said with Nate Pearson, right? It's don't get excited if it's a Nate Pearson you saw before the injury.
Agreed.
You know, and you know, I mean, the beauty of the way this, I guess if there is a beauty of the way this schedule sets up, is Charlie could have a couple of games to play around, if you will, to play around with his pitching and maybe get a sense of where guys are. But, I mean, look, you're right. It's a team that doesn't have anybody with a proven history of being a closer. You know, it doesn't have anybody with a proven history of being able to record saves in back-to-back postseason games the way Ken Giles's track record would suggest he could do. And that is going to be an issue. So, yeah, you very much need all hands on deck.
And the only thing I was going to say just really quickly is, like, you know, like, I get the sort of the idea of, like, 162 games does give you, like, a real, you know, fair data set to judge people on. But if you look at the reverse, Jeff, or the converse, the fact that it's so short, like, who knows? Like, maybe Jordan Romano and Nate Pearson have the best 2 weeks of their life, and that can change stuff. That there is a theoretical benefit of guys just statistically having, you know, just getting lucky in a sense and having great weeks against the Rays next week. It could happen. You know, it's we don't have the 162 data set, so I do feel like variables are far more likely in game 65 than they would be in game 175.
Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider with Tavia Sports. We'll get a preview of Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Final. We'll talk about the Andersons, the goaltenders, the Senators moving on from Craig Anderson. And, wonder if maybe the Toronto Maple Leafs may be moving on from Freddie Anderson as well. We'll find out from Ren Lavoie next as Writer's Block continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We'll be right back. Blue Jays baseball tonight on the network. 6:30 first pitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 1. Masahiro Tanaka on the mound for the New York Yankees. Robbie Ray for the Toronto Blue Jays. The Jays 12-1 losers last night. This is the third of four games against the Yankees, followed by three against the Baltimore Orioles and then a first-round playoff meeting likely with the Tampa Bay Rays. Now, there's another Tampa Bay team, of course, that is still playing in the Stanley Cup playoffs. They're, point of fact, in the final, the Tampa Bay Lightning. And their series is tied at one game apiece with the Dallas Stars. Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider. He's from TVS Sports. He joins us in Writer's Block. Ren, you're just got a few more bubble days left, my friend, and then then we'll play the song Freedom for you when you join us and come out of it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not that bad, to be honest with you. You need to look at the big picture. And as we mentioned or alluded last week, you have to wonder when will be the next game. So
enjoy
in
it.
A way, yeah. That's the thing. You need to enjoy what's going on right now, because honestly, I'm looking at what's going on with the NBA. The commissioner talked yesterday on CNN, and you know, if they want to play now in January, there's the New York Post saying that it could be for the NBA as late as March 1st. So, you know, it is what it is. You have to look at the big picture and say that we're lucky that we're watching hockey right now.
So what do you think? What are the chances we see Steven Stamkos tonight?
I think they're pretty good. I'm not saying I can't confirm to you that he's playing, but he was not on the ice this morning. So if he was not on the ice this morning for an optional skate, and obviously the players that are not playing tonight were doing some some extra, some overtime on the ice. He wasn't there. So, and I don't think that he's injured again. So, in a way, I do believe that the chances are good that he's going to play. We talked today to John Cooper. He said that he's getting closer. At one point you have to think that he's going to play. If it's not tonight, it's going to be next game. You have to look at the back-to-back coming too. It's three games in four nights coming in. It's not going to be easy, but we'll see. I'll know more probably in an hour. That being said, as of right now, the chances are good. That's the way I see it.
Ren, the series is tied at 1-1 based on the eye test, and in this case, your eyes.
Yeah.
Who do you think is the better team?
You have to say the Tampa Bay Lightning. And I know, and when I was talking to friends today, I said, you know what, I wouldn't be surprised if the Dallas Stars win the Stanley Cup. But that being said, what the Lightning did last game was really impressive. And I'm not talking about the goals necessarily here, Richard. I'm talking about the way they react to all the hits that they got through the game, especially in the first. You have a guy like Eric Cernak getting hit really, really hard at the beginning of the game by Alexander Radulov. And, you know, he's a big monster defenseman. And I expected him to react. He didn't. Went back in the room, spent a few minutes there, came back, played a really good game. Obviously, we all saw what happened to Kucherov. He didn't reply to any hits. That's the difference for me. And John Cooper, when we talked about with him this morning, he said, he told the players, guys, we can't do the mistake that we did in the first game, which was going back in that penalty box, being involved after the whistle. We need to play whistle to whistle. We don't have the energy to play after the whistle. And I think it's really, really smart. And I believe that's exactly the way the Dallas Stars are going to play tonight, because Rick Bowness, for the first time in a long time, was not really happy yesterday. When we talk about it, game two, he was really upset with the way his players played. And I think we're gonna see a really good response by them. But overall, I believe that the Tampa Bay Lightning is the best team.
Yeah, and I think too, if you're Rick Bonus, you've got to be looking at that Tampa Bay power play and what it was. 2-for-4, it went 0-for-14. You know that team is too good to go 0-for-14. Although we have seen teams with a lot of offensive talent. Yeah, hello Toronto Maple Leafs, with a lot of offensive talent struggle on the power play. Yeah. But I would think, you know, after seeing what Tampa Bay did, and if they get Steven Stamkos back tonight, I'm sure Rick Bonus basically say, guys, enough's enough, right?
Yeah, it's obvious. Listen, the Lightning struggle in the first game with their power play. The reason why is it was the first time that they were seeing a team playing like that versus them on the PK. So they needed to adjust. So we saw, John Cooper do a little wrinkle after the first power play goal. And it was obviously to one of his assistants, meaning we got it. We know exactly how to adjust. And I think it all goes through, Kucherov, the way he's playing. We don't know now if he's going to shoot or if he's going to pass. Is he going to pass to point or Palat? I mean, that guy is just a beast out there. And it's fun to watch. Honestly, it's fun to watch. And when you have a guy like Kucherov playing that way, he's one of the best players in the game right now. So you have to be really, really, really careful, and you need to be disciplined versus a team like that.
Ren, I wanted to get your quick take on the awards that were handed out a couple days ago. Anything, yeah. Anything either come to mind in terms of surprises for you? Or yeah. Maybe just some people who you feel were just richly rewarded for excellent years.
I'm okay with all the rewards that were given. The only question mark, and it's no disrespect to Roman Josi, he's a great defenseman. But you have to wonder what John Carlson needs to do now to get that trophy. The problem with John Carlson over the years was quite simple. From October to January 1st, he was the best defenseman. Point-wise, he was always on top, and he was really playing well. But after that, he wasn't able to get, the points per game that he had in the first 3 months of the season. When you look at the way he played this year, he was capable of playing really well for 70 games. Point-wise, he was always there. I didn't see his game go down. And you look at the way the Capitals played during the playoffs, he wasn't there much. And if he was there, he wasn't healthy, and it shows. You see that there's a great value with that defenseman. And I think that people are overlooking the way he's playing defensively. I saw him play defensively, being between the benches or at the Zamboni the year they won the Stanley Cup. I never believed that that defenseman was a good defenseman in his own zone. But you know what? He showed me, he's the opposite of that. He was playing so well. He was so calm with the puck. Like, the guy was really, really good. I'm not saying he's playing always that way, but he's one of the reasons why they won that Stanley Cup. So for him, I'm a little disappointed that he didn't get the Norris. I'm happy for Roman Josi, deserve all the credit. But you have to wonder if John Carlson is going to win that Norris Trophy in his career if he didn't, he'd obviously receive it a few days ago.
Ren, what does the future hold for Craig Anderson now that we know the Senators will not be offering him a contract? And here in Toronto, of course, there's a lot of talk about Freddie Anderson and what the future may hold for him. So let's talk about the Andersons, shall we?
Yeah, why not? Craig's going to be a really good backup somewhere, a luxury backup. I think he's still got some games in him. It's obvious if he wants to come to play. I mean, he's got he went through a lot with his wife, had cancer. She had to battle through it. And they were not living in the same city for a while. It's not easy, as everybody knows. So it depends on what the family is going to decide here. It's not, I don't think it's Craig Anderson by himself. It's really, what do we want to do? But I believe, like, he still can play. And now there's a trend in the NHL. You have to have a really good backup, and I see him. And when I'm saying a backup, can he be like a Yaroslav Halak on a team? That's what I believe that he can really be. And if needed during the playoffs, he can really help you too. So that's really the way I see his future. On Frederick, I've heard the rumors, and there is tons of rumors right now involving goalies in the NHL, especially with Marc-Andre Fleury. You have to wonder what's going to happen. Can he go back to Pittsburgh? Can he play in Colorado? I mean, there's a lot of rumors involving him, and I think that it's got an impact on Frederick too, and his future. I'm not saying that it's for sure that Frederick Anderson is going to be traded by the Maple Leafs, but I'll say that since the last month, it's been out there. So, and there is some rumors with Pittsburgh there too. So we'll see how it's going to turn out. Obviously, I believe right now the Penguins are trying to move some players around, and they need help at the blue line. So that's why there was a trade today that seems to happen. It's not there yet, but I believe at one point it will. We'll see. There's a lot of moving parts right now, and there's a lot of good players that are going to be traded. So if Frederick Anderson is traded, I believe the return is going to be really, really interesting for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Ren, one of the stories that obviously it's the story that will produce a lot of pages, a lot of print here, will be Alex Pietrangelo in terms of what ultimately will happen with him in St. Louis. And I've certainly read this week a lot of people who cover the Leafs sort of trying to figure out what possibility could exist to bring him in. Interestingly enough, most of the possibilities involve getting rid of Frederick Anderson and getting a goalie with less money. So a couple things. One, from what you've heard, where does his allegiance ultimately lie with the Blues? And then if not, what teams would be realistically could realistically bring him in?
Well, you know what, John, I see him. I'm pretty sure that he wanted to stay with the Blues, but it didn't happen, and it's okay. I mean, it's not easy, but I believe that he wants to go back home, and home is Toronto. And there's a trend already. You have a captain in Toronto that decided to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Yes, money-wise, he's getting a lot of money, but that being said, you never know if other players around the league are seeing what John did and say, you know what, I want to do the same thing. I want to play for my own town. I want to win a Stanley Cup with the team that I grew up watching. You never know. And at one point, and in a way, it's part of it. But at the same time, it's a business. He's got a great agent. They know exactly what they need, what they need to do. But you have to wonder sometimes: what's the difference really between $7 million per season or $9 million per season? You're gonna say it's $2 million, but I understand. But when your bank account is already, there's plenty of money in that account, you can play for yourself and you can decide exactly what you want to do and where you want to play. So that's probably it. I'm not saying that he's going to play for the Toronto Maple Leafs for sure, but if he's not playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs next season, there'll be a story out there at one point. I don't know if it's going to be early after he signed or way after during the season, where he's going to say that, yes, he thought about playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs. I believe it's part of, of what he thinks. I'm not saying it's going to happen this way. I've heard some players who even call me French Canadians thinking about playing for the Montreal Canadiens. They decided to stay with their team, or they switched because they didn't see a fit. But yes, it's part of the discussions, I'm pretty sure. And if they can get a defenseman like him, I think it's going to change the Toronto Maple Leafs. I mean, We mentioned it when the Maple Leafs were playing during the playoffs, how they needed somebody else at the blue line. It's no secret. I mean, it's obvious that the Toronto Maple Leafs needs help. So, and if they can find a way to get Pietrangelo, that's going to be a hell of a team, I'm telling you.
Good stuff as always, Ren. Thank you for doing this.
No problem. Enjoy. I'm not going to say your weekend. It's a little early.
Yeah.
The rest of the week.
It's never too early for the weekend. Thanks, Ren. Be well.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Ren LaVar, NHL insider with TVA Sports. And again, game three of that series goes tonight on Sportsnet. We will step away, and when we come back, it'll be the stretch drive. We'll get you set for Tim and Sid. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Our friends Tim and Sid are just around the corner. They will have Kenny the Jet Smith and the one and only Elliot, the Jet Friedman. Maybe not. I don't know. We need to come up with a nickname for Elliot besides Friedge. Kenny the Jet, that'll be fun. I don't know if you saw on Twitter the... Kenny the Jet getting raced by Ernie the other night. That's such a that is just such a magical show, Deitch. I mean, that's only right. Word for it. It really is.
I will say that it, you know, most television shows, Jeff, and you've obviously been part of a lot of TV. You know, there's pre-show meetings and people have an idea as to what they're going to talk about, even if they don't script it. Like, you know, what's in the first block, which they call the A block on TV or the B block. I always think, on top of the fact that they have great chemistry and great personalities, the genius of that show is they do no pre-meetings. They don't know what Ernie's going to talk about, and they just sort of do things impromptu. And it's just unlike, or it has been unlike, any traditional sports studio show. It's so great. And I find myself just sometimes, Jeff, maybe not during the playoffs, but like, you know, I'll stick around even if it's a lousy game just to sort of hang out and listen inside the NBA after a game, just because I think there could be something interesting from that show just because of the guys there. You're right. It's such a great show.
And you know what the thing is? Like, this is it's something that I've always kind of noticed. There is a certain walk that old basketball players have, you know, from the far, far too many nights of pounding on the hardwood. And I love watching Charles and Kenny, because they have those walks, right? You know, Shaq is Shaq. Shaq's got the Shaq walk. But Charles and Kenny both, when they walk, like when Charles does his broom thing or Kenny goes up to the big screen, they've got the sort of tired old basketball knees walk.
That's right. Yeah. The thing about, like, the and this is sort of one of Barkley's geniuses, I think Shaq too on TV, is they're so famous, but they're willing to sort of mock themselves or be mocked, which I think makes for great television. You know, usually when you are that well known, you're not going to put yourself in situations where you just, you know, you look goofy or people are just totally mocking you. And that's part of what makes that show great. I do think, though, the secret sauce has always been Barkley. It's just he's unlike anybody probably in the history of sports television, and in just saying things that are unique, and his ability to morph between the serious and the not so serious.
Hey, was he? I admit that I was not, you know, I followed basketball, but I mean, it certainly wasn't when I was covering baseball. It wasn't the sport that I necessarily focused on. Was it always taken for granted that Charles was going to be a TV guy?
No, he just was a guy who always, like Jeff, was known as like one of the best interviews in the NBA.
Okay,
and he I wouldn't say he fell into it, because he certainly talked to ESPN and Turner after his career was over, but he never talked about, like, during as a player, like, I want to be a broadcaster. If you remember, Jeff, going back, do you remember how many times he talked about being in politics, running for governor of Alabama?
That's right. Yeah.
That's what people thought he was initially going to do, was going to sort of head into that direction. Then he talked about being part of a basketball team, like a GM.
Right.
But I think he just, honestly, I think he had success fairly early. I think the television people knew what they had. And as Barkley would joke himself, he's like, you know, I'm getting paid millions of dollars to like work one day a week. What idiot wouldn't do that? And so I think he got it right away that this was a pretty good life for him.
That is it for us today. Kenny the Jet Smith, Elliot Friedman, and Tim and Sid. Don't forget, we will have Blue Jays baseball as well. First pitch, 6:37. It'll be Robbie Ray for the Jays, Masahiro Tanaka for the Yankees. Jays coming off a 12-1 loss. Two more games against the Yankees. Three more against the Orioles. Magic numbers two. It's off to the playoffs. The pandemic playoffs. That's it for us. We'll be back tomorrow.